Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new research or columns published recently in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa.
Today, we're going to be talking with the first author of a wonderful article on faith-based organizations in the African-American community.
So we're very lucky to have Dr. Sydney Hankerson, who's an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center, here to talk with us about his recent paper in Psychiatric Services, Engaging African-American Clergy and Community Members to Increase Access to Evidence-Based Practices for Depression. So Dr. Hankerson, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for the introduction. I'm delighted to be here.
So I think it'd be great to start off, as we usually do, with just a little bit of an introduction to your story, how you got to this point in your career in this area of research.
So my story begins in my hometown of Fredericksburg, Virginia. The church, my local church, really shaped so many aspects of my life. My father is a deacon at Shiloh Baptist Church New Site, which is a church where I grew up in. And my mom actually played the piano for the little kids choir. So she was my music teacher at school. And on Sunday, she played the piano for the choir. I was in church Wednesday night for choir rehearsal and Sunday for service. So it really was a hub of my kind of social as well as kind of spiritual development. And as I, you know, grew up and realized kind of historically the importance of faith-based organizations in the African-American community, especially in promoting issues around social justice and equity, around that same time in college, I was falling in love with psychology. And I was a psychology major and then went to med school and fell in love with psychiatry. And at the completion of my residency, I went to residency at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and did my training at Grady Hospital, which is, for folks in New York, it's like the Bellevue or the Harlem Hospital of the South, a big county hospital that serves predominantly African-American and now a large Latinx population of people who are undocumented, who are uninsured or on Medicaid or Medicare. And I was really heartbroken by just the poor quality of care that people received at Grady, as well as the many factors that contributed to them having to be hospitalized on the psychiatric unit, whether it was not having insurance, whether it was fear of getting psychiatric treatment that caused people to come really, really late and have really terrible symptoms. So I was really struck by this. And so that really moved me. And almost every patient that I saw at Grady talked about the importance of faith in their life and really wanted me, either them or their family members, wanted me to talk to their pastor or talk to their deacon. Because, you know, Atlanta is kind of the center of the Bible Belt in the South. And so I kind of saw in clinical practice the opportunity potentially integrate psychiatric care and, you know, a person's faith and the role of the church.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
Do you think that you were listening for that and you heard it? Or were people very upfront about their desire to have you talk to the deacon at the church?
People were very upfront about it. It was not something that I, you know, had went into expecting, but very upfront about it.
In some instances,
insisted that, you know, the pastor be on site, especially for family meetings, like on the inpatient unit.
Do you think they would have said that to you if you were white?
That's a great question, Lisa. Honestly, I don't know. There are some of my white colleagues who did not have that. And we did talk about, you know, asking about kind of a person's faith and the role of their faith in their life. But they're more likely to talk about that. Mm-hmm.
Because maybe they were more comfortable saying that to you.
Yeah, maybe.
Or, you know, as you're talking, I was also thinking about just your own personal experience and just being sort of like attuned a little bit to listening for things. And people can really pick up, I think, on some of those subtle cues that you know what people are talking about sort of like right away. So I wonder if that also, but, you know, I also wonder if you're talking to some of your other colleagues, if it was really just so central to people's lives that it came up in conversation with people.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. It definitely did.
Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can just sort of sketch out your where that's led you now in terms of your like research program, and we can then get into this paper and talk about how it fits into that broader research program.
Sure. So I, finished residency at Emory in 2009 and came to Columbia for a research fellowship. And I knew that I wanted to do something in disparities. And I wasn't sure yet. Most work in disparities at that time was really focused on assessing the effectiveness of like collaborative care. So that's when collaborative care was getting a lot of the evidence base was being established for it. And so I wasn't as interested in that from a kind of a research perspective. And this is kind of my, always my interest in NAMI, and I've talked to Lisa a lot about NAMI, but I did a talk at a large church in Queens. NAMI sponsored a suicide prevention program at this church. And I talked about the stigma of mental illness in the Black community and why stigma contributes to folks delaying treatment. And after I gave that presentation, so many members of the congregation came up and talked to me and asked for my card. And I said to myself, I remember having lunch with some friends on the Upper West Side that day. I said, I could do this for the rest of my life. And so it just felt like I was marrying kind of my two passions. And so I was, you know, I applied for a Young Investigator Award from the Brain and Behavior Foundation and was fortunate to get it. And in that study, it laid the groundwork for all of my future research, really. So we conducted focus groups with pastors at that same church. And then we expanded and did the first ever kind of church-based depression screening study with the Patient Health Questionnaire 9, where we identified high rates of depression across three different churches. And that really laid the foundation for trying to provide connections to care and even church-based mental health services.
So what about this paper? Can you sort of walk people through what this paper is about, how that fits in, and what you're trying to accomplish?
Sure. So this paper really was trying to see if it was feasible to train clergy in an evidence-based depression intervention called interpersonal counseling. And so interpersonal counseling is a 3-to-6 session version of interpersonal psychotherapy or IPT. And so it's kind of a briefer version of that, developed by Dr. Wiseman at Columbia. And it was developed for non-mental health professionals. And so for this project, we were trying to get perspectives from pastors as well as community members to see, would it be feasible? What were their perspectives of training pastors in IPC? Would community members go to their pastor if they knew that the pastor had been trained in IPC? And what would, you know, support that or what would impede that training and uptake as a strategy to reduce racial disparities and depression treatment? So that was kind of the overall focus and context for the paper.
And then what did you do to figure some of that stuff out?
So yeah, so we conducted, you know, individual interviews with pastors from the church. This was a large Baptist church in Harlem, in New York City. And we conducted focus groups with two particular kind of community volunteer groups from the church. One was a group that supports people with substance use and other drug use disorders. And the other was from a food pantry ministry that served food for people who are homeless in the community.
I'm curious
why this particular church and what how you developed your relationship with that church, and then how did you recruit for participants in the focus group? How did you interest them in participating?
Well, so I've created the relationship with the church by spending a lot of time giving presentations, meeting the pastors on several occasions. And it was about a year before we got to the point of applying funding. So this was actually a New York State Office of Mental Health, policy scholar grant that was used to fund this particular paper. And so it was about a year worth of developing partnerships with the pastor, with other members of the church. And then we applied for this grant together to try to develop IPC. And that is kind of how we developed the partnership with the church.
But they knew that you were a psychiatrist interested in collaborating.
Yes, yes. And so this church was unique in the sense that they had a mental health professional on staff, at the church who provide, individual counseling, for church and community members. So that was really the draw to the church, was because they, the pastor was very open about addressing the mental health needs of the congregants. And they had on staff a clinician who provided, therapy, she was on there full time 2 days a week. And so she in the grant was actually partnered with her, and she was basically functioned as a research coordinator for the grant. So she was instrumental in recruiting both all of the focus group participants as well as the pastors.
Has that been a kind of typical way that you've engaged with some of these churches and communities, or is it? It sounds like it's a lot of legwork and a lot of showing up.
Absolutely, it is. So all of my studies use kind of principles of community partnered participatory research, where it's kind of a two-way partnership between academicians and community members, and I really try to incorporate and leverage the expertise of community partners from the settings where we'll be working, and hire them in different capacities to help do the work. And so that's exactly what we did in this study here.
Okay, so you've engaged with the church, you set up focus groups to talk with both pastors and people at the church about how they would view this intervention that can be administered by clergy. So what did you find out in talking with people?
Well, I think kind of breaking what we found out down into what the pastors told us and then what the community members told us. So the pastors told us the thing that stuck out to me most was that they clearly identified a need for training. They talked about how they would often feel overwhelmed with mm-hmm. the stories that community members came to them with, and they felt ill-equipped to be able to sufficiently support them. And they talked about the importance of building relationships and having, solid referral networks to connect community members with mental health professionals. They also told us that they, as we outlined, what interpersonal counseling was and outlined its rationale and what it focused on, they were very clear that they were interested in learning the content and that the training they thought would be beneficial for them, but they were as equally clear that they were not interested in seeing more people and that they did not want to be counselors as part of a research study because they had other competing demands and they had enough on their plate. So that was a surprising finding because going into this, we expected them to be really open to seeing more people but they were very clear that they, thought the content and the theory of it was great, but in practice that it was not something that they would be able to do and were not interested in doing. And so the community members told us that, that the church was a natural place to increase, access, to depression care. We talked about like their perspectives of screening folks for depression And they talk about the importance of, you know, doing that within small group settings to protect people's confidentiality. And then when we asked if they would actually go see a pastor for counseling, they were very clear that they wanted the pastor to be able to show some type of certification. So show some type of proof that they were, you know, able to deliver this type of therapy with high quality. And that was actually surprising initially, but when we think about it and think about African-Americans in psychiatric treatment, one of the huge issues is that African-Americans often don't get quality mental health services. And so I think what we were hearing was that the community members really wanted to make sure that the pastors were well-trained and that the IPC was certified.
I found that to be very interesting as well, that in some sense, the need to monitor quality even superseded whatever love or relationship, you know, positive relationship that they have with the pastor.
Yeah.
That you know, it really almost elevates the concern, potential mistrust. And I know you've talked a little bit about that in the paper, but I found that to be pretty powerful, actually, and actually good. I mean,
yeah. I you know, thank you for saying that, Lisa. When I did the study, I went through a range of emotions. I was initially honestly disappointed because my thought of doing this study was completely thwarted. So I was honestly disappointed and had to quickly, you know, shift gears. But I think you're absolutely right that they really told us, hey, we want to make sure that we're getting good care and that quality supersedes our relationship with the pastor. And we want to clearly delineate, you know, the pastor's role as kind of a spiritual figurehead versus someone who's providing, you know, any type of mental health treatment. So that delineation was really important.
Yeah, I've come to think of these certifications as something that's, you know, like a regulatory or oversight capacity that you have to be kind of meeting certain standards so that you're kind of in line with the rules and regulations. But thinking about it as something that's actually driven by the community is like a really eye-opening.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So were there any other, you know, I know the point of qualitative research is to apply scientific methods to some of these stories, but were there any other moments in the in some of the interviews that kind of jumped out at you or that stuck with you while you were or had some kind of like emotional resonance with you?
Yeah, I think that one of the other key themes was the distrust of institutions that these community members had, in particular, distrust of healthcare and mental health professionals. And one quotation really stood out to me where one of the, you know, community members talked about never having seen a Black psychiatrist before. And so that there was something very meaningful about me being there, you know, as an African-American psychiatrist and leading this study and doing research, because there was both distrust with clinical services and then distrust with research, so that there was something very powerful, almost a sense of pride. You know, that was kind of the underlying message that she had in seeing me and being able to say, hey, here's a Black psychiatrist. So that's something that I also was very powerful, you know, for me.
Do you have that in your, in some of your other research where you personally have a sense of like, breaking ground?
I do think that part of the challenge but also joy of this type of community-based work is that it does take a lot of boots on the ground and a lot of time building relationships to be able to get to the point to be able to collect data and then publish it. But in that you know, relationship building process just comes a real appreciation for why we're doing this work. You hear kind of the duality of struggle and overcoming, of pain and resilience, of suffering, but also joy and community cohesion. And so I think being able to hear firsthand kind of those dualities and those stories is what really keeps me going. you know, in moments of challenge, you know, with any particular study.
You also, the third key theme that we sort of touched on minimally, but which I'd love to hear more about, is this issue of depression stigma.
Mm-hmm.
What can you explain that to our listeners and why it's important?
Absolutely. So depression stigma, you know, did emerge as a significant barrier for folks in our study, both from the pastor's perspectives as well as from the community members' perspective. And so they kind of define stigma as kind of this fear of identifying or acknowledging that you have depression, or fear of or negative pushback from social networks, from family, friends, of having a mental illness. And so stigma is certainly pervasive in all communities, but I think there was an added layer in a faith-based setting around stigma, because in many houses of worship, there's a sentiment or a notion of, well, if you have enough faith, then you won't get depressed. Or if you pray hard enough, that you won't get depressed. So I think that our participants really talked about stigma on multiple levels, from kind of concerns or negative perceptions from community members or family members, but also how the impact of religiosity could actually be stigmatizing towards mental health conditions as well.
Did you notice or touch on other types of mental disorders, or like psychosis, or, you know, trauma, PTSD? Did that come up?
You know, in the paper, we focused on depression, but people did spontaneously talk about all different mental disorders. Mm-hmm. I remember people talking a lot about trauma. The focus groups actually ended up being kind of like a quasi-support group because mm-hmm. people talked about trauma. They talked about experiences of attempting suicide. And they did talk about one person acknowledged that she was taking an antipsychotic, and others talked about family members who had been hospitalized mm-hmm. for what sounded like, a primary psychotic disorder. Mm-hmm. So definitely all of those things did come up.
And they're all the stigma also being.
Oh, stigma was huge in all of those.
It sounds like a very supportive, a very therapeutic focus group in some ways.
In some ways, it did kind of become like a therapeutic session.
So what's on the horizon for you?
Well, the thing that we're working on now as it relates to church-based work is very fortunate to get a R01 study that actually is a natural progression from this paper. So, you know, just to summarize the results again, the pastor said, we're not going to do interpersonal counseling. And the community member said, well, we want something that's certified. So, you know, IPC is not certified. So we really had to pivot away for both of those reasons from that intervention. And what we've ultimately created, myself with Elijah Day Williams, he's co-director with me of Columbia's Wellness Center. And we've created an institute for training community health workers. And community health workers are trusted paraprofessionals from a local community who know the community, who speak the language of the community, and have access to the community. And so we've developed this training institute, and all of the community health workers thus far have been recruited from churches in New York City. And so we have a federally funded study that is leveraging these community health workers in 30 churches to screen people for depression with the Patient Health Questionnaire 9. And then depending on the church study site, it's a cluster randomized trial. So half of the churches are referred to kind of culturally tailored motivational interviewing. And the other half of the churches are randomized to enhanced usual care, which involves, educational pamphlets about depression, a one-time session to assess people's health insurance status, get them enrolled in health insurance if they're uninsured, and then giving them a list of referrals. And so we're comparing to see the impact of, you know, this culturally tailored MI delivered by community health workers compared to enhanced usual care, how that will impact treatment engagement, which we're defining as you know, attending a clinical encounter to get support for depression. And so, you know, this study was launched last year, of course, in the midst of, you know, COVID. And so we spent the last year pivoting from in-person recruitment to video. We created this video, Lisa, I shared that with you. That's our primary recruitment tool that involves a pastor. The pastor from this paper in Psych Services is featured in our recruitment video because he tells his story about having recurrent episodes of depression and going to see therapy, and he sees a therapist. And we contextualized his story as a way of trying to engage people and recruit people in addressing some of the depression stigma that is pervasive in the community and getting people to recruit for this particular study. So that's what I'm really excited about. And it has taken, you know, the bulk of my time and energy. And so that's the main kind of church-based work that really is a wonderful evolution of the study that we published in Psych Services.
Very exciting.
Thank you.
I am sure that many readers and listeners are excited about what you're doing and may want to try to be a part of this kind of work. So what should they do? What advice would you give to emerging, you know, mental health professionals, not just psychiatrists, but how can they contribute?
That's a great question, Lisa. And in terms of contributing, you know, to this type of work, I would say for psychiatrists who, you know, are in clinical practice and who probably don't have time or limited capacity to take time to form extensive relationships with faith-based organizations, I would say just make yourself available as a referral source, you know, to churches. Because one of the biggest things that came out of this paper was the pastor's recognition that they need to have people to whom they can refer and trusted providers, people who understand and can talk about cultural issues and can talk about racism and can talk about discrimination and can talk about a person's spiritual beliefs in therapy, which many mental health professionals, I think, have struggled with. So I think that's one thing that way that people can get involved. Another way, you know, all of our studies, again, use kind of this principle of community partnered research. And we've created this Community Coalition for Mental Health, which is an advisory board that provides community-based support for all of our studies. I encourage anyone to Google Community Coalition for Mental Health, and our website will come up. Please contact us. We can add you to our newsletter. Our meetings are open, so anyone can come and join and participate. And then folks can email me directly.
Great.
Sydney.Hankerson@nisbe.columbia.edu. So I would say those are ways to get involved.
So one last question for you, and I'm struck by at the very beginning when you were telling us a little bit about your background. You said you fell in love with psychology and you fell in love with psychiatry. And given everything else you've said, that strikes me as unusual. And I just wondered about what you think made you so connected to mental health and what, you know, if there was an important influence or how do you understand this really, well, how do you understand it?
Well, I mean, I understand it a couple ways. I think all of my psychology classes just captivated me. I've just been fascinated with human behavior and the unconscious since I could understand what it is. So that was a huge
problem. So there were unconscious drivers.
They're unconscious drivers. But then, you know, a clinical experience. So I did research between my first and second year of med school. And I went to med school despite really loving psychology. I wanted to be an oncologist because several people in my family had died from cancer, and I wanted to be an oncologist. And that summer, I did research in a breast cancer clinic. I had a wonderful preceptor, Bill Ely, who's a wonderful oncologist. And I found myself much more interested talking to the women and their partners about the depression and anxiety that they experienced about having a potentially terminal illness than I was in interested in, you know, their chemotherapy regimens or looking at an x-ray. You know, that stuff was really boring to me. But I could sit there for hours and talk to them and try to offer some support or hope or just listen. And so for me, that's when it really clicked that maybe oncology isn't the route that I should go. So I would say those experiences really shaped me.
Well, we're very glad that you had that experience and that you're here with us today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
So that's it for today. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the article we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. We also welcome your feedback. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. You can also rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. I'm Lisa Dixon.
I'm Josh Berzin.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual speakers only and do not necessarily represent the views of the American Psychiatric Association. The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only and does not offer medical or any other type of professional advice. If you are having a medical emergency, please contact your